The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Alexis Petridis. This is Music Weekly. This week...
When she phoned, I said, you're going to have a number one, you're going to do a tour, and I want to be on it.
Since the tour of life over 30 years ago, Kate Bush has never been on the road again. We hear what it was like working on the legendary tour from two people who were there, one of whom was her own stage magician. We listen to new tracks from Black Lips, John Talabot and Fucked Up. And Michael Hann will be telling us about his passion for Van Halen in the feature with no name. All of this, plus a lo-fi pop live track from Dom. This is Music Weekly from The Guardian. Hello, you'll doubtless be delighted to know that I'm back. And it's not just me that's back. Rosie Swash is back too.
Hello.
Well, I've got bones to put you, actually.
Why?
Where were you last week?
Where was I last week? I just had some time off.
Well, before we go any further, a very big thanks, obviously, to John Harris for standing in last week. Very eloquently presenting a special on Bob Dylan. If you haven't heard it, go back and download it after this week's programme. Anyway, also in the studio today is editor of Guardian Film and Music, Michael Hann. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Alexis. Hello, Rosie.
Hi.
Later on, you're going to be telling us about the little-known rock band Van Halen.
Alexis, they may not be little-known, but they are little-valued, and I'm going to tell you why you should value them and love them.
You
almost
have described
as much as you do 14 iced bears.
Hey, don't diss the bears. You have described Van Halen as the most important...
The most important white rock band.
Sorry, I paused because
from the Beatles.
I can scarcely believe what's written in front of me.
Apart from the Beatles, if you consider... we should come to this later, but if you consider bands that actually were popular, I think Van Halen have influenced more of them than anyone else apart from the Beatles.
Velvet Underground.
Yeah, there was 40 nice bears out of that, wasn't
there? I think you'll find the Velvet Underground quite influential. Anyway, don't tell us too much. We'll hear all about it later. Let's start off with some new music, though, and our thoughts on that new music. Singles Club. Here's this week's Chosen Three. We begin with Michael's choice. Thank you, Dad. What a racket. That's Family Tree by Black Lips. Michael, you brought that in. Tell us all about it.
Well, they've got an album coming out in a couple of weeks. That's the lead single from it. The album was produced by Mark Ronson, which seems like a bit of an odd choice for a band to associate it with being a horrible garage racket. Mm-hmm. I went to see them last week at the Garage in London, a more appropriately named venue for a band like that. It's hard to think of. Now, I'd seen them a few years ago and thought they were just shocking. You know, absolute terrible mess.
Really?
And as you know, Alexis, I do love garage rock.
Absolutely. 60s and 50s garage rock.
But last week, I thought they're absolutely compelling. By all accounts, some of the onstage wildness has been toned down. But what really shone out last week, I think, was actually the quality of the new songs they played. There's a real kind of early Beatles feel about them. I don't mean they sound like Love Me Do, but there's that same sense of kind of slightly rickety, propulsive energy, but really married to pop tunes. And I think Mark Ronson's production on the whole record is actually really, really sympathetic. I mean, it's, of course, we know that he can do 60s retro, but the way he's captured the whole garage band sound so perfectly, there's almost no middle in the record. The bass is turned quite low. It's just this utterly trebly racket.
Fantastic.
Where you can hear the bass line rather than this huge throb of bass, which is what you're used to. Certainly anyone driving past your house playing that through the subwoofer in their car, you're going to be able to still watch telly in your living room because it's all treble. Don't worry about that. But I mean, over a full album, if I'm honest, it gets a bit tiresome.
How long was the album?
The album's only album length, 45 minutes, something like that, but it's 16 tracks and you know what they do fairly quickly, and without the spectacle of the live band, it starts to wear a little bit. But if you listen to it three or four tracks at a time, this is the opening track on the album, as I say, the single, it's just thrilling. I really think they've pulled the cat out of the bag this time, just about.
Bit of honking sax on there, which is unusual, really, for garage rock.
Although, if you think back to early garage rock, you know, pre-Sonic.
Frat rock,
yes. Things like She Done Moved by the Spat, that sort of thing. You're going to hear sax on that.
The Stooges, of course.
Or the Stooges. It's a little absolutely. Bit different there.
Yeah, but you know, I just sax generally. I'm just riffing. Oh, God, I make myself awful. Rosie, did you like that?
I did. I do like the Black Lips. I think, you know, you could accuse them of being quite derivative, but I think one thing I've always really liked about them is that they are completely themselves. It's not a shtick. If you know, I remember seeing them live at ATP, I think it was 2007, and they were absolutely incredible. They just, when they get it right live, it's great. And so you know, they're just one of those bands that people say, oh yeah, you know, they spit and they do this and that, and it just sounds like this sort of parody of punk, but I don't think that's what they are. I remember interviewing...
They spit?
They're famous for all sorts of things, on stage nudity,
they don't spit at each other. What, the guitarist spits in the air and catches it in his own mouth.
To be fair, I saw Cage the Elephant do that a few years
well,
ago.
I've seen the 49ers, but that's what I'm saying. Exactly. That's what I'm saying is it's not new. Yeah. It's not interesting in itself, but that's not what's interesting about it. So you get this stuff told to you about what the Black Lips represent, and that's not what it is.
Yeah, and I think
there's subtlety to what they do as well, and their Good, Bad, Not Evil, which I still think is a fantastic album title. And that was a lot of those songs were about the war on terror, but they just didn't go around selling it as an album about the war on terror, in which case the title makes perfect sense and really interesting.
The point of order, the title comes from the Shangri-Las.
Yes.
It's from Give Him a Great Big Kiss by the Shangri-Las. And yes. Mark Ronson, a huge Shangri-Las fan, so maybe there's a bit
of... But I think you're absolutely right about how the reputation for wildness overshadows their actual abilities, because live, when they hit their stride, They're a monster. They're absolutely incredibly forceful. And they sound kind of tighter and more together than they do on record. And you'd think live would be the shambles, but the records actually sound more shambolic than the live show.
I think there's a real charisma to what they do, and there's almost a sort of, you know, evil boy band aspect to what they do as well, which I think they get very right.
Fascinating. No need for spitting, though, is there?
Never
need.
In your own mouth, it's fine. Do what you want.
I don't know. It's vulgar, isn't it? At best.
Anyway, that's Black Lips. When's that out? Do we know?
I think the single's out now. Actually, the album's out in a couple of weeks.
Okay, go and check it out. We're going to move on. This is Rosie's track. That's the second track from the Families EP by John Talabot, which is his first release to come out on XL, or rather the subsidiary of XL, called Young Turks. I'm a big John Talabot fan. I've been following his work for some time. Rosie, tell us what you like about that.
Well, I probably haven't been following him for a long time, but I remember hearing a single that John Talabot put out last year called Sunshine.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
And all I still know about him is that he's a kind of housey producer from Barcelona. Mm. That's all I know.
Yeah.
And it was Sunshine is absolutely fantastic.
Great remix as well by Blondes and DeLorean, both did amazing remixes.
Yeah, he does quite a lot of stuff with DeLorean.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And then I got this EP, and it's such an interesting track in all the things that it brings together. I think that you might easily assume this was a UK producer because it seems to have that kind of the effects on the vocals seems to have that dubstep UK dance feel to it that a lot of UK stuff has got at the moment. But similarly with Sunshine, he's got that almost xylophone effect running through it. It's a bit of a motif of his. I mean, it just really works. It's slow building. It's got something very propulsive and hypnotic about it. You know, in this very similar to Template to Sunshine, the song he had out last year, and the EP in itself, Family's EP. This song's called Lover's Tradition, but it kicks off with a song with Glasser, which is equally very, very good. I mean, I just think he's a really interesting producer, and he's got a distinctive sound.
Yes, he has got a distinctive sound. I was actually going to bring in, before you preempted me, the track with Glasser from that EP. No, I think it's really good. I think he's a really interesting producer. He's got a style of his own. He's one of sort of not very many house producers or working in the house, really. You say, I'd be quite interested to hear an album of his stuff, because it seems pretty varied while having a signature style about it. I really like that. The Holy EP is great. Michael?
It won't surprise you to know that I don't have quite as great a familiarity with his work as you, Alexis. You remember John Peel used to say of taking acid that it's like going to Stratford-on-Avon. It's all very nice, but once you've done it once, there's no need to repeat the experience. I felt a little of that about this. I kept waiting for it to do something, but I think that's my dinosaur anchoring in guitars, bass and drums and verse, chorus and middle eights. What it did remind me a lot of was a kind of updated, a looser version of Motorik. It has that same feeling of endlessly going on towards a destination that you never quite reach, which is quite appealing. I can imagine, you know, it's the kind of thing that actually over 5 minutes, because you think, well, it's 5 minutes, it's a song, something's going to happen. Actually, over 20 minutes or something, where it just continued to build and build and build, I think it would probably sound absolutely amazing. And I can imagine, you know, a live performance or whatever form the performance would take, were he doing it, I can imagine it being absolutely compelling. But at 5 minutes, it wasn't quite one thing or the other for me.
Okay, that's cool. That's fair enough. That's John Talabot, Lover's Tradition, from his new EP, Families. When's that out, Rosie?
It's on SoundCloud, and it's also on Resident Advisory.
Yeah, you can find it around the interwebs without much difficulty. Yeah.
The final selection, which is also available on the interwebs, is from me. That's my choice. Fucked Up, from their forthcoming album, David Comes to Life. That's called Queen of Hearts. I've been sort of circling Fucked Up for some time. I'm not hugely knowledgeable about the latter day punk rock scene, of which they clearly form an integral part. But they strike me as a more intriguing and weird band than a straightforward punk band. I saw them live in Brighton last year, and they were really good. I like the sort of Husker-Du-ish wall of guitars they've got going on that track. It's from an album, as I said, called David Comes to Life, a rock opera about a kid growing up in Thatcher's Britain, which is an amazing thing, really, for an American band. It's not without precedent to do a punk rock opera. Obviously, Green Day did one, but perhaps more pertinent to this, Husker Du's Zen Arcade from 1984 is kind of a rock opera. And it's very sort of tuneful while being very aggressive. I mean, the guy sings like that all the way through, which you know, wears a little bit, I find, but it's definitely potent, powerful stuff. And sort of, there's, you know, it kind of makes sense. I was looking at the whole sort of script of the rock opera is on the internet, and I was having a look at it, and I can see what the plot is, which
it makes a change.
I was going to say, it almost disqualifies it as a rock opera, if you understand what's going on. Ambitious, different, sort of noisy and thrilling,
but
is my summary.
Did you watch the accompanying mini-documentary they made with
No.
it? Because towards the end, each of the band members are explaining the concept of the album, and they all go, and then I don't know what happened. And then another one's like, you know, I'm totally pretty confused, actually. So
I agree almost completely with you, Alexis. I find them a very, very intriguing and interesting proposition, at times more intriguing and interesting than actually enjoyable.
Yeah.
I think they're clearly a good thing for the world. I think it's great that hardcore punk has produced a band that is managing to attract a wider audience and be taken seriously without actually surrendering what connected them to hardcore in the first place. Because once you're a hardcore band and you're no longer accepted by the hardcore scene, it's kind of, your existence is almost pointless. You're just another loud rock band.
Yeah, absolutely.
Pink Eyes, the singer, is an intriguing figure. But, yeah, it's the singing. Yeah. Singing like that is fine when the guitars in the background are going, do, 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 do. But when they're playing, yeah, they're playing really good, melodic, big rock now. Nothing at all wrong with that. But you want someone singing. When what you've got in the background is so melodic, you really want someone singing. Husker do realise that you have to have
there's
singing.
There's a balance
you,
to be
you
struck,
can't
isn't
just
there? Yeah,
bark.
Yeah, that's really true. There's certainly, I think there's a sort of vocal balance that Bob Mould strikes really well in Husker Du between it being kind of a sort of a bark and being melodic and tuneful. Intriguing character, Pink Eyes. Had a lot. I mean, no,
apparently that's not his real name.
Really? I was reading one interview with him. He said, "Who's your favourite punk rock singer?" Ian Stewart from Screwdriver.
Oh. We've had this conversation before. Americans get Oi wrong, don't they?
I think he's very much aware of what Screwdriver stood for and all that kind of thing. But he just sort of likes the. There's a lot of weird stuff about Fucked Up. There's a lot of kind of aspects of it where they're almost like, and this is a bizarre comparison to make, like a sort of KLF. Slightly performance art kind of thing going on. Rosie, are you a fan?
Well, I think like Michael, I have a great affection for what they represent more than the actual music itself. I've seen them live a couple of times and I really enjoy it from standing at the back of the room.
Yeah, I wasn't going anywhere near the
front. Yeah, exactly.
I felt like I kept jumping off stage and he was all sweaty. And
Pink Eyes is a huge bear of a man and he gets right up in the audience's face. And I also like, you know, I've always got a great deal of time for that template that hardcore bands do so well of here's our logo, here's what we stand for. You know, we're incredibly shouty, but we're also straight edge. Like, there's just something about that appeals to me. And Americans nail it. This band in particular, they remind me a little bit of Le Savvy Fav in the same way. Both bands have got this huge hulk of a front man who's going nuts on stage and jumping into the audience and doing all sorts, while the rest of the band are quite, you know, their shirts are ironed and they're playing really, really well and they're just fiddling with the monitor and they're not even looking at what the front guy's doing. And they've got that aspect to them. And I've interviewed them. I interviewed Pink Eyes, his real name's Damien, and he's one of the most interesting, polite people I've ever had the pleasure of, you know, just a real thinker and a talker.
Yeah. I remember, I haven't looked at it recently, but after I saw them live, I looked at the blog that he does. It was some sort of band tour diary thing. And A, it was really interesting and well written. And B, the musical recommendations on it were amazing. I mean, it's just incredible across the board, you know, really, really generally brilliant music that they seem to be into. You wonder kind of if this is, you know, I think this music has a kind of, not this matters at all, and obviously, you know, in some ways negates the point of hardcore in a way, but has a sort of commercial ceiling. You know, you can sign to a major label like Gallows did, but, you know, it's like, it's a tough sell for a wider audience. But, you know, you see them, I can imagine they could do brilliant at a festival on a main stage just by being their incredibly potent, powerful live band. And this is as tuneful as they get. Queen of Hearts by Fucked Up from the album David Comes to Life. The album is out, I think, on the 6th of June. But there's four tracks from it on their website that you can actually download now. So go and check it out.
And this is one of those tracks.
Yes, absolutely. On the blog last week, it was mainly comments on favourite Bob Dylan tracks. So jumping back a fortnight to the last set of tracks we had on, which were the Chemical Brothers, Junior Boys and The Joker with Jesse Ware, Ellie Moose said, "There's a subtle musicality in Joker's productions, buried underneath a lot of obnoxious dubstep weaponry, but undeniably there. Jesse Ware's track's a bit poor, though. She did better out of Sampha and Subtract."
That is a very good song. Valentine.
You agree with Ellie Moose. Excellent. Rob Jewett wrote, "Couldn't quite agree exactly with Alexis's claim about the Chems being forgotten men due to their consistently brill skills or similar, but I am in complete agreement regarding the effectiveness of the Hannah soundtrack. Worth splashing the cash on." I quite agree. We can't dig back into the tweets from 2 weeks ago, but a lot of your retweets were Emmy the Great's quote about making the world a better place by going to the library and borrowing a Bob Dylan record. Thank you very much for your retweets over the last 7 days. Leave your reviews and comments on what's in this week's programme on the Music Weekly blog, guardian.co.uk/musicweekly, or tweet us at Music Weekly Pod, all one word. Kate Bush has just released her latest album, Director's Cut, which I'm sure you know is a re-recording of tracks from previous albums, Essential World and The Red Shoes. Don't expect to be touring with this release, however. Kate Bush's last proper tour was over 30 years ago, and though she's occasionally appeared on stage to collaborate with other performers, including Rowan Atkinson, she's never done a full solo tour since 1979. The one tour she did, the Tour of Life, I believe it was called, the gigs were legendary for having a magician on stage. You don't see that very often. Fucked up. Don't even do that.
No.
As well as choreography, visuals, all sorts of technological things that are amazing for the time, like wearing a headset microphone. Sort of thing you take for granted now, but I think Kate Bush was the first person to do it. Rosie, all this intrigued you.
It did. I was watching, you can see a lot of her performances from Tour of Life, if not all of them, on YouTube, and I was watching them recently, and in her performance of Wuthering Heights, which she closed the show with, the credits came up. And the first thing I noticed was that she oversaw everything, every aspect of the tour. And then I noticed all these people that had been involved in it, like the magician and like that. And I just thought it sounded fascinating. So unlikely as she is to tour this album or even do that much press for it, I thought it would be interesting to hear from the people that were involved in that, the Tour of Life, as to what it was like to work with her and their experiences and their memories. One of the people that we speak to in this segment is John Henshaw, who's director of photography for some of her earlier videos, and he lit the concert for television. And Simon Drake, who was the tour magician, who appeared on stage with her throughout the performance. And here they are telling us about this legendary tour. It begins with me visiting Simon in his House of Magic in Amazing. Kennington, in South London.
I've been here for 15, 16 years. I sort of stopped touring and built my own magic theatre here in just over the water from the Houses of Parliament. And there's lots of amazing things here. So obviously, a lot of my work's visual. So when I do the show, I come down through a hole in the ceiling on this lift. And with blue light and sort of smoke coming down. So that's the one-person lift. The dancing cane that I still finish my show with was a feature of her thing. And the same stroboscope that I used then is still in use now. And I was reading my diaries this morning, and I see that halfway through the tour, the strobe broke down, and we had to get a spare one. That tour was full of incredible things, a lot of firsts, and huge tragedy. It was actually a year, pretty much a year, between me meeting her and the tour happening. We planned it probably from 6 months before the tour, meaning meeting every week. It's all in my diary. You can see Kate and Paddy round, Kate round, Kate and Dale round, or me to their place, meeting the band for the first time. It was very early in my professional career. In fact, it was kind of only a year into me being a full-time magician. And I worked for EMI before that. I was a record plugger.
Really?
Oh, yeah. But I'd been moonlighting all that time, you know, doing two jobs, you know, doing shows at night at the clubs, rock clubs, speakeasy things, with another name, you know, and a white face. I didn't wear a white face because I was any good at mime. I wore it to stop myself being recognised by the people at work.
I worked at the BBC 15 years. And I left to run a company which was optical effects for TV. And one of my clients at ITN was a guy called Keith McMillan. And he was a very early producer of music videos. And so then he started ringing me up, asking me to do things. He asked me to do Kate Bush's first number. And I declined it. I'd never heard of her. And then it made a big hit. And I thought, wow, if he asks me again, I'll say yes. Then one day, he said, can you have a look at this? And it was her concert in Manchester. And I played it, and I thought there was nothing on the tape. It was just so dark. He said, what do you think of that? And I said, it's K King Dyer, and he said, well, we've got to do it at Hammersmith Odeon.
My radio alarm went off really early and I'd hardly had any sleep. And it started with a song of Wuthering Heights. It said, and that was Kate Bush, who's interviewed tonight on the Tony Mart Show, tonight on Capital FM. Right? And I knew Tony Mart, but I knew better his producer, Eddie Puma. I got to meet this girl because he knew I'd left, we'd stayed friends, he knew I'd left the record business to be a magician. And he got her to phone me. And I said to her, when she phoned, I said, you're going to have a number one, you're going to do a tour, and I want to be on it. And then months and months passed, and she said she'd be in touch. And then we started meeting towards the end of that year and started planning, basically just ideas. I was working on Illusions where I take off my head and stuff like that, and a lot of that stuff's in these cabinets here. And she was really interested in quite a lot of that. And now, you know, and picked things that I was playing with that complemented. So then I'd listen to the two first albums and I'd suggest things for songs. I mean, I wanted Wuthering Heights. You know, I said, Wuthering Heights, we should do a silhouette screen with two lovers running to each other in silhouette on a hill with a tree and missing, you know. And she went, no.
She said, no. Yeah. The soldiers suffered, the war is over. The air is sheltered.
So I was 22, she was 20, and to be thrust into that position at that age, for anyone to have a number one for 4 weeks in this country at that age is going to be tricky. But then to take 50 people out on the road with not just a touring show, the stage tour. I mean, there's a lot of it. Costume changes, I lost count. I read something on the internet this morning in my research saying she never left the stage. Rubbish. She left the stage to change costume. You know, she did it all in an egg. No, she didn't. She rolled on in an egg at the beginning, holding the sides of it. It's a quilted egg. But it was a great thing. Very heavy.
Nothing had been done like it at all. It was completely new, and it was, to many people, weird. Who is this weird girl with a squeaky voice and everything? But it was compelling. You had to watch her.
Because this is rehearsals at Shepperton, March 79, KTB rehearsals. This started The Place in Euston, so we did some rehearsals there. A Little of Coffee Home Ground, Talk About Photos, I don't know what that is. Shepperton, 3:30 to midnight.
That was a rehearsal.
Yeah. Look, there's a stage set picture, really bad one.
Is that Kate?
That's the set.
Oh, that's
no, that's probably my little drawing. Could be hers, it could be anyone's. But the set that eventually became this Anx cross. Worked on L'Amour, Coffee Hongo, Strange Phenomena. Idea of, I can't read that. Something in Heartbreak. Getting shock off mesh screen and hair going up. Good day.
There'd been some knocks on that tour at the beginning. Her lighting man, Bill Duffield, had been killed on the first show. And I think that's very much affected Kate.
Bill was brought in last minute because he'd done this fabulous design for Gabriel's tour. And what had happened is he'd gone back into the venue to check if there was anything left behind, like a roll of tape. But he went in through the audience and the cleaners had opened the hatches to clean things. And he fell down a cleaning hatch at the top of the stalls a long way. And I think he died a few days later. If you find the tour, you can see where it says. So got bad news about Bill Duffield. So we got the news on the 4th, mm-hmm. and this had happened at the first show, Poole Arts Centre. Just terrible shock, and very concerned. Everyone was very worried, you know, if we could pull it together. So it upped the ante of the nerves like you wouldn't believe. And obviously we're all quietly kind of concerned for Kate, because it's her head on the block, in a way. It wasn't why Kate hasn't toured again. I don't know for a fact, but I'm fairly certain. It's the fact that it's such a big group effort, and you've got one shot at it. And I think that's much more to do with the fact that you can't control it.
What is your favourite memory? You know, you were saying you're going back through all these.
My favourite memory was her in rehearsal showing up saying to 45 people at Shepperton, saying,
"I understand one or two of you are a little bit late this morning, and I'm sorry, but it's just not going to do."
In its day, it was really quite something, but it wouldn't be impossible now. But I guess, you know, now she's in her 50s and has a family. I don't know, would she be driven in the same kind of way? I tell you what, if she did have a tour, I'd be there in the audience. I'd love to go and see it, and I wouldn't mind lighting it.
That's John Henshall and Simon Drake talking about Kate Bush's 1979 tour of Life. Why do we think she never toured again? I mean, they sort of speculate a bit there.
I think she is a very complete artist in the sense that some people are driven to perform for all the wrong reasons.
Mm.
And I think she has a very clear idea of what she wants to create, and she doesn't have that burning desire for the public's love, which is what a lot of famous people's, you know, famous performers' drive is from. What she has is an idea. She puts it out there, and she's happy not to have another one for 10 years.
Yeah,
and she doesn't have to financially. She's from an era. She's made her money.
Mm.
And someone like Lady Gaga, who I'm not comparing the two in any more sense than Lady Gaga does have this ridiculous tour now that in some way bears a similarity to the theatricality of the Tour of Life, and must take a great deal of organisation, and by all accounts comes a lot from Lady Gaga's planning of it. But it's very necessary for artists to tour these days, and Kate Bush is from a different time, so she did it, she didn't have to do it again. You know, I mean, there was an article in NME after her first few albums, like, where is she now? Mm. And a week later, she put out Hounds of Love. I mean, talk about fuck you, do you know what I mean?
I think it's fascinating. There's that sense of, I mean, I mentioned this in the review that I wrote of Director's Cut, that she said in something I was reading, a recent interview, that she was forced into doing a lot of stuff when she was really young. I mean, she's like, press stuff, you know, promotional stuff that she didn't want to do. And if you go on YouTube, you can see sort of clips of her on Delia Smith talking about vegetarianism and stuff like that. And, you know, it's kind of awkward. And she said, you know, that she just didn't, she suddenly realized she didn't have to do any of that. And, you know, there's something also quite sort of sexist, I think, about the way these things are. You know, it's like, you're dealing with this kind of total one-off original, you know, original artist, and it's like, yeah, you're a woman. Get on Delia Smith and talk about food. Put a Laura Ashley frock on, you know.
We ran a piece about this tour in Film and Music, I don't know, 18 months or so ago, by Graham Thompson, who'd written a biography of Kate Bush, and the sense I got from that piece was that she kind of didn't enjoy it that much, and the effort that would go into kind of topping it if she tried to tour again would just be unsustainable. I mean, as Rosie mentioned earlier, there are clips from this on YouTube, and apparently Kate Bush experts say they didn't catch a good night. But they are astonishing. You know?
Really? In what sense?
Every single song is its own production. You know, every single song is treated as a story with a different character doing it. So one minute she's an RAF pilot in the Blitz. Mm-hmm. The next minute she's a 30s American gangster. It's extraordinary looking. It's not a rock show at all. It's got nothing in common with a rock show.
Especially the rock shows of that time.
Yeah, right?
Any other
Which was usually blokes with half a dozen gel lights.
Yeah.
And a drum writer, and sometimes not even a drum writer, if it was a budget show.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, at least if she got pushed into doing stuff she didn't want to do, promotional things she didn't particularly want to do, she had the last laugh in the end.
Yeah.
I think the phone call, you know, to EMI, when she put out Ariel. You know, yeah, yeah, that's my new album. Yeah, it's double album. It's got Rolf Harris on it. Singles me doing an impersonation of Elvis. Tell you what, you mark it. I'll put my finger up. See you in 12 years' time, yeah? Apparently, the Red Shoes, I believe, was initially intended as a more band-oriented effort that she could tour. There was a sort of intention of going touring, but something went a bit awry, clearly, during the making of it, because as opposed to heralding a return to live performance, it heralded her retreating from public view for the next 12 years.
It should also be said that, you know, she was always a physical performer as well. She danced constantly on that tour, and a whippet-thin 20-year-old who does the Kate Bush dancing that we all now know and love is a quite a different experience from a 50-year-old woman going on tour. Maybe she just doesn't want to do a one-dimensional stand on tour and sing when she can't really do the other stuff that she used to be able to do.
Isn't it nice that we're here speculating about a rock star?
High-quality journalism.
I mean that in a genuine way, in that I know everything there is to know about Lady Gaga.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? There's nothing you can speculate about. And it's like, I know almost nothing about Kate Bush.
The internet has robbed us of mystery, and mystery was a great thing for pop music.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, the director's cut is out now. I really like that album. I think it sort of condenses two of her less beloved, so I suppose, works, and really makes you kind of think about them. It actually makes you go back to the original albums and realise that they are really very good in their own right. That's out now. The feature with no name, Michael Hann.
Yeah, well, a group very much like Kate Bush.
Absolutely, the American Kate Bush.
That's right, they had long hair. Van Halen. Now, Alexis, Van Halen, I suspect I am the only person sitting at this table who loves Van Halen.
I like Van Halen.
Hey. I've got to say, it's kind of the last 6 months I've become really obsessed with Van Halen. As you know,
very much of the moment, I'm not surprised. Yeah.
As you know, I have a 70s and 80s hard rock predilection. I grew up as a prepubescent headbanger. So Van Halen, a group I've had a sympathy for, but the last 6 months I've been listening to them an awful lot, and they are truly an astonishing group, Alexis. Now, you laughed at the beginning of the show about my assertion that they're the most influential most influential white rock band apart from the Beatles. Now, you say the Velvet Underground. Yeah, of course lots of groups influence them, but only six people ever listened to most of these groups. Van Halen influenced pretty well every American rock band that sold a shedload of records.
In what sense?
Over an enormous period between the late 70s right through to the arrival of Nirvana. Now, the problem for them, of course, is that virtually every single group they influenced was a disgrace in every way, shape, or form.
A disgrace to the name of Van Halen.
Well, a disgrace to the name of humanity. I mean, Poison, Motley Crue, Cinderella, Warren, all that rubbish. But Van Halen, I think the first Van Halen album especially, from late 1977, it's a real game-changing album. You know, I've seen it mentioned elsewhere, on a par with Are You Experienced or Nevermind the Bollocks. And I think actually that's perfectly appropriate. Van Halen genuinely reinvented hard rock. If you listen to the first Van Halen album now, and I asked you what year it was from, I reckon there's a fair chance to say 84, 85. It sounds years ahead of the game. It's a sound that didn't date for another 15 years, which is an incredible achievement.
In what way is it different from what? What did they do?
What had come before? You know what early 70s hard rock is like. Bluesy, sludgy, it trudges. Van Halen was all about lightness of touch, about speed, about attack, but about melody as well. I mean, of course, the best way to appreciate this is to actually hear some Van Halen.
Okay, well, let's hear something by them. Let's hear Dance the Night Away. Van Halen there with Dance Night Away. That's from their debut, their eponymous debut album.
That's okay. Actually from their second album.
Okay.
Van Halen 2. Their second eponymous album.
Of course it's called Van Halen 2.
What year is that out?
And that's 78. I think that's late 78 or early 79. Now, I think what sets Van Halen apart is that unlike their influences only listened to Van Halen. Yeah, but Van Halen were completely different. Yeah, Eddie Van Halen taught himself to play by, you know, the kind of traditional rock thing of taking Cream's version of Crossroads and slowing it right down so he could learn every note. Invented what was completely his own style. But Dave Lee Roth, a genuinely interesting character.
He certainly is.
Well, he is in all sorts of ways. He came from a Jewish man who had family in the New York bohemian scene. His uncle ran the Café Noir in Greenwich Village.
Wow.
So, yes, he used to see all that bohemian stuff as a kid. And Eddie Van Halen talked about him in the first Van Halen interview from 1978, where he says, Dave, our singer, doesn't even own a stereo. He listens to the radio, which is a good variety. That's why we do have, if you like, on the record, Ice Cream Man, which is an old blues number, which is a change from the slam bang loud stuff. You know, we're into melodies, melodic stuff. Most of our songs you can sing along with, even though it does have the peculiar guitar and end-of-the-world drums. And I think that's an interesting thing, the fact that Dave Lee Roth was not tied down to one single thing. And kind of the tension between him and Eddie Van Halen was what eventually kind of tore the group apart. Eddie Van Halen, you know, wanted to be taken seriously as a musician. David Lee Roth was, to all intents and purposes, certainly in public,
like an entertainer.
A clown.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, a showman. And it resulted in some genuinely strange music as well at times. Their fifth album, is that right? 1, 2, 3, 4, I think Diver Down, which is, by most rational standards, terrible. You know, most of it is covers. But they just sound so utterly unlike you expect. There's a version of Pretty Woman on there, the Roy Orbison song.
Right.
Which, when heavy metal bands do rock and roll covers, it's normally a rock and roll song speeded up.
Yeah,
it doesn't tend to sound unworldly. And yet, you know, they could still really, really rock. This is the thing people forget. I mean, a song like Unchained, which I believe we have ready to cue
up. We're about to hear, yeah.
A remarkable heavy rock song.
Yeah, Van Halen with Unchained.
It's always a shame we have to fade out just the chorus comes. I think it's a great chorus. But though that's the way of the world. But David Lee Roth. Now, as I was saying, a very interesting man. There's an interview with him by Lisa Robinson from 1984, which he goes through. He's really playing with her. Yeah, he makes references to John Cassavetes and George Bernard Shaw. He clearly knows what he's talking about as well. He's not just he's seen these names in newspapers somewhere. But he kind of pins down what Van Halen means to him. He says, I would still prefer to think of us as witless and tasteless. Arch enemy of the common public. That's all I wanted to be in life, really. I always wanted to be an outrage to public decency and a threat to women. And this is one of the few occupations where you're not only allowed that, but you're encouraged. And I think that quote almost completely sums it up. It's appalling. You know, I want to be a threat to women. What a terrible thing to say. Mm. And yet at the same time, you're aware this is a role he's trying on. Mm. It's a really interesting dichotomy at the very heart of Van Halen,
which
makes me sound like a real ponce.
But clearly the subsequent bands that you're talking about,
they were just
a threat to women.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there was much more to Van Halen. And another thing Roth says in that interview, which talking about their influence, suggests that he's aware of the wider world as well. He says, I know for a fact that to a small degree we've bred a small legion of imitators, copycats, mimics, people who are using Van Halen for their prime and sole inspiration. But even more important than that are all the people who are just disgusted and revolted by our music and our presence and our appearance and the way I do interviews. And they've been forced to come up with some very substantial musical alternatives. And he's kind of right, isn't it? Because no heavy metal band or no hair metal band ever formed because they were fed up of hearing Bogshed or the Minutemen on the radio. But plenty of Bogsheds and Minutemen's formed because
absolutely.
I was sick of hearing the likes of Van Halen on the radio.
This is fascinating. Rosie, you said you're a fan of Van Halen.
I'm not a fan who knows a great deal, but I would say that all the things that Michael says about them are the things that I've always really enjoyed about them. There is a tastelessness there that is so in your face. I adore it. Is it Just Like Paradise or Living in Just Like Paradise?
Just Like Paradise.
The video for that is outrageous and is that Dave Lee Roth era or is that Sammy Hagar? I don't want to get the wrong. I'm pretty sure it's Dave Lee Roth, like doing these ludicrous kung fu kicks across the stage.
That's
and then it cuts to him abseiling down a cliff in what look, Nevada or something with a 200-foot drop, but at speed, like a little spider across the side of it. And then it comes back to the set, and it's just like him just embracing life like some kind of maniac, and I really like the jeans.
So if you watch any footage of Van Halen, even live footage, they do appear to be revolting individuals. It's all winks and points and nods and tongues coming out. They just look like the most revolting people. You really wouldn't want to spend an evening with them. But there's just such a huge but with them. They did something incredible. And the other thing is, actually, for all that Roth says people hated us, kind of a lot of American alternative people have always had a kind of secret love of Van Halen. I think one of the reasons they're not valued that much here is they didn't play here that often. Mm. Although on their first visit in 1978, they did come up with the single greatest onstage announcement ever. Van Halen supporting Black Sabbath at the Lewisham Odeon. And Dave Lee Roth said, "Hey, Lewisham, the rock and roll capital of the universe!" Which I thoroughly admire. In fact, one of the first things I heard by Van Halen after I'd gone indie, after I'd renounced heavy metal, was on an SST compilation, the Blasting Concept, where they had the Minutemen covering Ain't Talking About Love. And they weren't doing it because they thought, here's a joke. Mm. They were doing it because it's just self-evidently a great song.
Is there a sort of cut-off point with Van Halen's material after which...
And we know where that cut-off point is. It's when Diamond Dave leaves and Sammy Hagar comes
in. But the success continued in no uncertain terms.
They were more successful. They sold more records with Sammy Hagar. But artistically, the Sammy Hagar Van Halen is the Doug Yule Velvet Underground.
Wow. The two Van Halen songs that I know...
You're going to say, "Why Can't This Be Love?"
Why Can't This Be Love? Yeah, yeah.
Jump's ace. Jump's great.
Jump's great. Yeah,
Aztec Camera did a brilliant version of Jump.
Well, there you go. this is fascinating. I mean, absolutely fascinating to hear a band like this contextualised in a slightly different way by you. We've got one more track by them. What are we going to hear?
We're going to hear the one that Minutemen covered, but we're going to hear it in the Van Halen original.
This is Ain't Talking About Love. Van Halen's Ain't Talking About the Love there, concluding the feature in that.
It's the best thing ever written about not caring about Arthur Lee.
Michael, thank you for doing that. A genuinely eye-opening thing. Before we wrap up for the week, Michael, tell us about the Music Power 100 that is in this week's film music.
Yeah, well, a few weeks ago, we sat down with an advisory panel of industry experts, including Jeff Travis, the legendary head of Rough Trade, Cern Canning, who manages the vaccines, and Franz Ferdinand, among others. Terry Hall, not of the Specials, but of Hall or Nothing, PR and management, who worked very closely with the Manic Street Preachers. Paul Scaife from Record of the Day, and Jonathan Morris, who's a long-standing industry veteran. We sat down in a room with them, and we tried to work out who the 100 most influential people or persons in the UK music industry are. By that we meant the people who have the greatest influence over what we hear or our listening habits right now. And it was, got to say, it was a fascinating exercise. One of the really interesting things that came out was the importance they all attach to teams, because there are other power lists around the building. The media do theirs, which is always individuals. Film, we did one last year for film and music for the film industry. And that was mainly individuals. But music, it's full of teams. People said you just can't separate them out. They were all about stressing the primacy of the artist. Now, number one was Adele, but they insisted it had to be Team Adele. So Adele, Richard Russell from XL Recordings, Jonathan Dickens, her manager, and Brad Hunter, the radio plugger. And so, listening to people who are really on the inside of the industry talk about the way it works, I mean, it's a really enlightening experience, seeing how many different parts have to come together to make something successful. And also, slightly chastening experience as we realised what little influence print media exercises.
No. Rosie in there? No. It sounds really interesting. What other? Give me some other names that are in there just for
wet people's appetites.
Well, the digital stuff, a lot of digital stuff was very high, as you won't be surprised to hear. One thing they were insistent was about was that MySpace is not the power it used to be. MySpace squeezed in at 100.
Wow.
They said 5 years ago, it probably would have been in the top 10.
What is
not
the,
now.
What is the way that music's disseminated?
Facebook, very important. Twitter, very important.
Wow.
You know, Facebook, you share the music with your friends in a way that no one does on MySpace anymore. Apparently, there are now some bands whose management's advised them don't even set up a MySpace account.
Really?
Gets lost and just seems a bit crap in this age.
That's amazing. And I suppose also what you could do is, like, Odd Future have their own Tumblr. And they post all their stuff on there. So why would you need
to? We didn't have Tumblr, and Tumblr was a name that came up. People were mentioning that. I mean, we were trying to get a balance of things. Sure. And like all these things, you're not... Maybe shouldn't be taken completely literally. Oh, this person is the 73rd most influential person. You're trying to reflect the broad range of jobs that take place. So, yeah, digital was important. Live music, very important. TV and radio, very important. I'm wondering if there are ructions in Radio 1 today, because our people suggest that Nigel Harding, who we were told basically looks after the playlist, he's ahead of George Ergatoudis.
I was going to say, not George Ergatoudis.
Who is famously the most important man in Radio 1, but our panel was sort of saying to us, guiding us away from that, saying, George is crucial, but Nigel Harding is the man who actually picks the records you hear, and since commercial radio takes their lead from Radio 1, he's the most important man in pop radio.
Well, this is all absolutely fascinating. You can see the whole 100 in guardian.co.uk/film and music. Thank you very much for coming in.
It's always a pleasure, Alexis.
Thank you, Rosie.
Thank you.
As ever. We'll leave you with a band that Paul Lester has been raving about in his new Band of the Day column on the site, calling them No-Fi Post Drums Neo Chill. This is Dom and their track, Jesus.
Great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.